This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 4th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Today I'm joined by Arifa Akbar, literary editor of The Independent. Over the next 15 minutes or so, we'll be discussing the new novel by Julian Barnes, The Noise of Time, The High Mountains of Portugal, another new work by another Booker Prize winner Yann Martel, and an unusual collection of love letters entitled The Passion of Mademoiselle S, Letters to a Lover by Jean-Yves Bertaud. That's all to come on today's edition of the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Arifa. Your first pick today is The Noise of Time by Julian Barnes. It's a fictionalized biography of the Soviet-era composer Dmitri Shostakovich. It's the author's first full-length novel since winning the Man Booker Prize in 2011 for The Sense of an Ending. So there were obviously huge expectations on this work. In your opinion, did it live up to them?
In my opinion, no. But I'd also say this book has utterly divided the critics. I'm in the minority camp that really felt this book was... It's elicited strong passions, either way. Most critics have felt this is magnificent. They're normally the critics that didn't like Sense of an Ending. I adored that Man Booker winning book. And so I did come to this with massive expectations. And I just thought it was a failure, but you know, there's plenty more that will contradict me very passionately, so I would urge readers to make up their own minds, but do take on board my very strong reservations. I think the subject matter is one that's very close to Julian Barnes. He has a passion for classical music that he's talked about. This book is about Dmitri Shostakovich, so it's a sort of fictionalized biography historical novel, which Julian Barnes has tackled before. You know, he's with this one, this one focuses on Dmitri Shostakovich and his relationship with Stalinist terrorists, the Soviet regime, and Khrushchev's regime too. So we go through the sort of main, it seems like the biography, I didn't really learn a lot about Shostakovich the man. This was his relationship. It was a very erudite novel. It's written in very intimate, sort of free and direct speech. So even though it's third person, he said, he did, it feels very intimate. But it's erudite. It's his relationship to the Soviet regime, the idea of artistic compromise, because he was compromised. His opera, you know, and several works were denounced, and he had to toe the line. He was accused of being too formalist, you know, he had to toe the line. This book is about how you resist, how you have your creative resistance to tyranny, and whether it marks the soul and it scars someone like Shostakovich, which it did, full of self-loathing and hatred for himself, I think.
It's interesting that you say you don't learn much about the man, because the way the book is set up, you don't actually know that it's Shostakovich for a while.
I mean,
it talks about a man and it's very vague, and then sort of a few pages in, you then find out that it's actually Shostakovich. So it's interesting that then you end up not really finding out that much about the man.
It's interesting you say that, because until he drops it in on whatever page, maybe it's page 20, so a number of pages, you don't know it. You're right, you don't know it's Shostakovich. And that opening, for me, was fantastic. It was full of tension and a sort of just tension and drama. And I thought, this is going to be brilliant. I whizzed through those pages and suddenly you think, oh, it's Shostakovich. This is Shostakovich's life. And from then on, it just shifts gears for me, and it never shifted back to that initial excitement that this is going to be pared down, just tension, drama full of tension, which the Sense of an Ending was.
Exactly.
This is sort of like Sense of an Ending in the sense that this is about a man reflecting on, it's about memory and retelling your own story, reflecting on his life, the right and wrong bits, the mistake. You know, Sense of an Ending was the big unresolved mistake in his life, and Shostakovich was an obsessive character. Barnes has studied him extremely thoroughly, and all the facts are in there. But I don't think, you know, being faithful to your subject is enough. This is a piece of fiction. So you see in the constant repetitions in this book about Shostakovich, you know, this idea that he's somehow failed himself by making those artistic compromises, but then he's grappling and saying, well, I did resist and put in my covert resistance within the music. Is art corruptible or is it impervious to that? There's all these erudite questions. There's this constant retelling and redefining his own story, but it has a sense of stasis. You know, nothing moves. There's no narrative propulsion. We don't really learn, even though there's a drama of all these big ideas and the drama of, you know, is Shostakovich, does he regard himself as a coward? Nothing happens beyond these big ideas. His wife dies. There's no emotional sort of real-time feeling around that. There's no connection. There's no reflection on sort of the agonies and ecstasies of writing these marvelous symphonies. We're taken through this life through ideas, and we're described Soviet terror in, I'm afraid, familiar terms, because we've read so much about Soviet terror. A lot of this is familiar, this tyrannizing, the artistic tyranny and compromise. It wasn't new to me.
So if you put yourself in the position of a critic who liked this book, I mean, what is there to like here? I guess you found it.
I think people have said how what a clever sort of structurally he takes you through, he plays a sort of literary game. This isn't a biography. Maybe I'm the one who's expecting a conventional, you know, fictionalized biography. This isn't a conventionalized fiction, but Barnes always plays clever, you know, literary games. This is a sort of internal reflection. This is about memory and the way we choose to remember some things, and we choose not to. We choose to smooth over and retell our own stories until they sort of suit us. We come to our own understanding, very edited understandings of ourselves that make ourselves palatable to ourselves. It's quite psychoanalytic, isn't it?
Yeah, very interesting.
And I think this is what Barnes's Shostakovich is doing in this novel. So he's retelling these stories to himself. For me, that retelling, it might have been faithful to the obsessive personality and faithful to Barnes's literary, you know, game, the shape that he wanted this novel to take. But it became quite high-pitched and hysterical and repetitive, and I wished for the tension and drama of the first few pages before we knew who we were dealing with.
Right. That's The Noise of Time by Julian Barnes, which is out now, published by Jonathan Cape. Your second pick for today, Aretha, is The High Mountains of Portugal by Jan Martel, who is, of course, most famous for Life of Pi, which came out 15 years ago and also won the Booker Prize. There are several parallels to be drawn between the two novels, not least the fact that they both focus on a transformative relationship between a man and an animal. But before we come to that, let's start with the structure. Aretha, how is this book put together?
It's told in three parts. They could almost be three standalone stories, but there are certain running themes. I mean, they have three separate protagonists, so all the characters are largely different, apart from the spectre of the death of a boy, an accident, that looms and in a way joins up all three. Having said that, I don't think loose ends are tied, and I don't think it's very joined up, but the themes are there. So each of the three stories deal with three different men who have lost the women they love, lovers or wives. So great sense of bereavement and loss, and a loss of faith, religious faith as well, that cuts across the three stories. And how to recover, the question of how to recover after the person that you love and invested everything in has died, but also how to recover your faith, your relationship with your spiritual relationship, how to recover that. And in a way, we expect, in stories, I think largely we expect resolution and epiphany, you know, especially we strive for a happy ending, in that we want these characters to recover a sense of hope or faith of some kind. And there's sort of some anti-epiphanies here. So he deals with faith and loss well, I think, But for me, the fact that it's chopped into three parts and that you're chopping between the century as well. So the 20th century, it begins at the beginning of the 20th century in Portugal, then, you know, jump 40 years ahead and then jump to sort of near present when a Canadian senator goes to the hills of Portugal, mountains of Portugal, sorry. And it has a sense of stopping and starting and sort of stalling in its changes of stories. I felt really disappointed by the end of the second part.
Mm.
And then suddenly everything changed for me with the third section, which begins with a Canadian senator. He again has lost a wife and he's looking for a way to survive spiritually. And then we've had in the previous two sections, these simian motifs, you know, monkey element, ape elements, which have never manifested in the animal itself, but they're there. Third part, the Canadian senator befriends, I won't tell you how, it takes too long, befriends an ape called Odo, and they go on this, in a way, a road trip, and it becomes that thing that Jan Martel does so well. This man befriends animal and learns from it, sort of story, this narrative. I wish he'd taken that third story and just made it the full story. It would have been magnificent because it had so much emotional drama. And what I think Jan Martel really excels at is this man and animal relationship. Particularly, it's not a Disney version of, you know, anthropomorphizing this animal, but regarding its profound otherness and sort of appreciating, understanding that this man's healing might come from the fact that this friendship with this animal is based on awe and fear and a sort of lack of ever knowing what this other being is thinking and how it's going to behave.
There's this so very, very much like the tiger, I guess.
Absolutely,
in Life of
like the Bengal tiger. There's a really moving quote, which he asks himself, the senator, does it bother him that the ape is essentially unknowable? No, it doesn't. There's reward in the mystery, an enduring amazement, which I think sums up how he does that relationship so well. I just wish we got more of it in the book.
And it's interesting. You mentioned that the three parts, you don't feel like they hold together particularly well. But the prevailing theme of the collection is kind of spelled out in the three titles of these three parts. It's Homeless, Homeward and Home.
Yes, yes.
What do you make of these titles? I mean, do they offer any insights to the reader?
I wish I think it's a clever thing to do, to head towards something. But the annoying thing is you're in that geographic terrain, you know, within these mountains of Portugal, and the themes of homelessness and journey and belonging or home are there. But I feel that it's a bit of an artifice that actually this is another loose end. You know, you're heading towards something and you don't know what it is even at the end. I think it's so full of concepts and ideas that I just wish it had been more about the story rather than, you know, the ideas around the story.
The High Mountains of Portugal by Jan Martel is out now, published by Canongate Books. Our final work for today is The Passion of Mademoiselle S, Letters to a Lover by Jean-Yves Bertaud. This, which is, I guess, as you would surmise, a collection of love letters from an unknown woman called Simone to her lover Charles. The pair lived in Paris in the 1920s and their correspondence charts a two-year affair. Charles was a married man. But before we discuss the content of the letters themselves, we should address the circumstances of their publication. Aretha, tell us how they've come to be in the public domain.
Well, really intriguing story, and not without its ethical issues for me. So the editor was rummaging around a friend's attic and clearing out and came across this bundle, and the bundle turned out to be these just one-sided letters, so only from Simone, not from Charles. So we're assuming that Charles felt tender enough towards her to keep them. And so what the editor is bought these letters from his friend. So that this is written in the introduction, and that in itself intrigues me, and I kind of see it as if not problematic, just curious. There's unanswered questions. It doesn't say why he had to buy them. Why would you buy them? Where's Simone's family? Where is the sort of connection, the connecting familial line? You know, what's happened to these letters to leave them sitting in an attic so that they have to be purchased, you know, from someone else? So there's those unresolved things that aren't resolved within the text.
I was going to ask, so in the introduction, yeah, this is left fairly ambivalent, is it?
The editor is saying, you know, he bought them because he felt they were so fascinating. They were such a fascinating insight into an affair, but also that they were an example of, you know, erotic writing, and, you know, and they could sit in that canon, and they're explicit, and they're even pornographic, but there's enough emotional drama there that I think I agree with him. But I'm just a bit nonplussed by the fact that he bought these letters, and I wonder what Simone would have made of them, and I wonder if there's an invasion of privacy issue there. Of course there isn't, literally, because poor Simone is long gone. But a letter, I just feel a love letter particularly is a sort of sacred covenant, isn't it? It's between me to you, to, you know, sender and recipient. It has such an intimacy. And I don't think, you know, it's a bit like the diary, and there are some diaries that are written with a view to being published, aren't they? Particularly writers by public and literary figures. And so our letters, perhaps, again, you know, we get the letters of T.S. Eliot, we get the letters of a lot of literary figures that we admire. Those letters, I think, there's no issue around publication or no ethical sort of grey area. But I don't know whether I'm being a bit of a prude here just because of the sensational and very highly charged erotic nature of these letters. But she wrote them to her lover, and now we're reading them. I felt a bit of a peeping Tom. I've got to be honest. As fascinating as they were,
are you convinced that they are real?
I mean, I'm not sure.
This is another question, isn't it?
It is, because I mean, you know, you might know that France has such a long, fine tradition of literary hoaxes. Part of me thought, well, this editor hasn't made clear. You know, he hasn't joined up the letters with why he had to buy them and the friend and the attic. Maybe there's deliberate sort of emptiness and gaps and unanswered questions because it is a hoax. Who knows? But, you know, as letters in themselves, I do think that they are completely fascinating. I mean, they'll make any modern reader of 50 Shades blush. They play with gender. They're very contemporary. There's sadism. There's quite a lot of violent passion. So his sadism, her masochism. There's also really fascinating. This was probably the thing that fascinated me most was this question of a woman in the 1920s writing about her sexuality in a really brave, bold way. There's elements of you know, the traditional masculine sexuality that she takes on, and she calls him Lottie, her female lover. So she's writing in a brave way. She's expressing female sexuality, you know, in the way that women, groundbreaking writers have in erotic literature. But at the same time, she's also expressing the female insecurity of a mistress. She's forever worried that he might lose interest. She's upping the ante, you know, in these letters, making them more erotic, more charged, more pornographic, because she wants to keep his interest. She wants to tell him, I'm your mistress and I will do anything in the way that your wife won't. So there's this vacillation between the female, you know, empowering of writing out your sexuality, but at the same time, it's there in the story of, oh, you know, that seminal erotic fiction, erotic story sort of text. You know, I'm writing in this very bold way, but really, it's for the sake of keeping my man.
Interesting. The Passion of Mademoiselle S, Letters to a Lover by Jean-Yves Bertaud, is out now, published by William Heinemann. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you very much to my guest, Aretha Akbar. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow to review films with Anna Smith. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks very much for listening.